We've been asked to talk about sustainability and make a sustainability check for 2015. And I think if we want to look at this in a way that's helpful for how do we think about these issues, we need to step back a little bit. One of the things I do, and with my organization we try to do, the Copenhagen Consensus, is to try to focus on priorities, to say, what are the most important things? What we often hear is a vast range of different issues we should be concerned about. And yes, there is lots to be concerned about, but we also need to get a sense of what should we be most concerned about? Where is it that we should focus first? So let me take a step back and first say, how have we done? Then let's look at how can we move forward and what should we be focusing on? And then I'd like to single out one issue where I think we need to be very careful. So let's remember one of the points with sustainability, and unfortunately this is one of the things we often forget, we believe that sustainability is only about environment. It's very often portrayed that way, but of course it's about sustainable economy, sustainable society, and sustainable environment. It's wonderful that we now also recognize it's not just about having economies work really well, we also need to make sure that we actually get environment working along with it. But we need to remember all three of these things. One of the points I want to show you is, if we just take a step back, let's just remember over the last 150 years, phenomenally, we've done better on all three accounts. So let me just show you on economy. Jacqueline told us how inequality is increasing. That's probably true, certainly in national levels. The global level actually probably shows that there's a slight decrease because the Chinese middle class is actually making up for the fact that we are getting more unequal, for instance, in the OECD. But let me just show you this one graph on extreme poverty from 1820 till today. And of course, you have to recognize that the data is not entirely comparable. As you can see, there is a break in the short and the long run. But I think this is a phenomenal outcome. We have moved from a world that in 1820, more than 90% of all people on the planet were poor. This year, World Bank actually estimate will be the first year the world will have single-digit poverty in the world. That's an amazing achievement. This does not mean that there are not lots of other problems, but let's just remember that we have actually done pretty darn well. Now, but of course, this is just economy. Likewise, if you look at social impacts, life expectancy over the last, what is that, from 1820, so almost 200 years, right? We've probably gone up from less than 30 to more than 70. We believe it's 71 today. I can say this because I didn't make up this metaphor, but I think it's a wonderful metaphor. We have basically been granted two lifetimes. Each one of you have two lifetimes. My medical colleagues keep telling me that every 4 weeks you live, you will live an extra week. Life expectancy still went up 2.5 years in this world the last 10 years. We tend to forget. So again, let's remember, this is outstanding. It doesn't mean that there are no problems. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be focusing on the issues that are still left over. But we need to remember. And likewise, when we talk about environment, we have the sense that everything in the environment is getting worse and worse. Let's just remember, the world's worst, and Jacqueline alluded to this, the world's worst environmental problem is air pollution. And the worst of those two, indoor and outdoor air pollution, is indoor air pollution. Indoor air pollution kills 4.3 million people each year. That's by far the world's biggest, in terms of number of dead, the world's biggest environmental problem. And just notice how it's gone. I only have data from 1900, and we have also prediction. Basically, that has dropped dramatically. We're probably in a position where we live, where we have about reduced the risk of death about 3/4 over the last century. That's a phenomenal outcome. Remember, to a very large extent, this is because we have gotten richer. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why people don't light up in their kitchens anymore. Remember, about 3 billion people still cook and keep warm with dirty fuels like wood and cardboard and dung and whatever they can get their hands on. The World Health Organization estimates that, on average, is the equivalent of each of these 3 billion people smoking every day 2 packs of cigarettes. Not surprisingly, that's not a healthy thing to do. Of course, we don't worry about, or at least I don't worry about going into my kitchen because I don't use wood, I don't use dung anymore, I use electricity. And of course, that's one of the things we need to remember most other people, so the last 3 billion people on the planet, also want to do. But this was just the past. Let's move into the future. What should we be focusing on? We need to make sure we make a better future. Now, that comes back to the whole sustainability. We need to remember to get a sustainable economy, sustainable society, and sustainable environment. And we need to remember that there are trade-offs between these. If we focus on some things where we do little good, it means that those resources, that focus, that attention can't be spent on all the other areas. So we need to get this right. And that's really what I've tried to do with my organization, try to focus on not just doing something that makes us feel good, but do something that actually does the most good. So this is the project we've done. This is the short version of the book. We have a 500-page book coming out with Cambridge University Press, where we've looked at all the different things you can do in the world on the Global Development Goals, so the Sustainable Development Goals. They insist on calling them the Global Goals now. If anyone wants a copy of this book, I don't have any physical copies, but give me your card afterwards and I'll get you a PDF. I'll show you just a very quick outline, and I'm sorry, there's no way you can read all of this. But that's not really the point either. We have asked 140 academics, 82 economists, including several Nobel laureates, to look across all the different things you can do in the world. So most of the global goals, not all of them, because some of them were really, really hard to quantify. And take a look at how much will it cost to fix each one of these problems. And then we have looked at how much are the benefits, both in terms of economy and in terms of social impact and in terms of environment. But crucially, we try to put all of these things together. And I realize we have a conflict brewing with Uri because he was very annoyed that we were just putting things into one measure. But I think we have to recognize that most governments and most of us think about politics as spending money. And so we need to know how much good does that money do. What we've tried to do is to say, for every dollar you spend on a particular issue, how much good do you do? Let me just show you a few of these. For instance, on gender, and again, you probably can't see that up here, but we found that increased access to contraception, basically 215 million women don't have access to contraception right now. That means that they have more kids than they'd like to have, or at least not the right time. And it probably also means that they're a lot less productive, probably means that they don't get as much education as they would otherwise have done. The cost of providing that is about $3.6 billion a year, as estimated by some of the biggest organizations in the world. But the benefits are twofold. Partly, you will get fewer moms dying. We estimate about 150,000 women won't die in childbirth, and you'll have 600,000 kids who are not left motherless. But it'll also drive more economic growth, because at the same time, you will get a slight, what the demographers call, a demographic dividend. You'll simply get societies where you have fewer kids, fewer old people, lots of people in the productive ages. A little bit like what China got with its one-child policy. Not at all like that, but a little bit. And that in total, if you make up all the numbers, it turns out that that gives you, for every dollar you spend on contraception, you do $120 worth of good. That's a phenomenal investment. That's one of the investments we should be focusing on. But notice also there are other things. For instance, for women, we show that, for instance, especially if I can use this, if you look at reduced child marriages, turns out to probably not be a good idea. That's not because we say, hey, child marriages is a good thing. That's not what we're saying. But we're saying we've seen repeatedly that we've spent lots of money on child marriages and actually managed to do very little, simply because we go out and tell people, you shouldn't be doing that. But there's structural reasons why they keep doing it. And so what you need to do if you want to reduce child marriages is give better legal opportunities, better business opportunities for women, make sure they get better education, get better nutrition. Those are the very simple things, but not deal directly with child marriages, but deal indirectly with child marriages. So essentially what you can see this graph as is a way of showing which of the targets are phenomenal targets and which ones are not. Our argument would be to say, given that we're not going to do everything over the next 15 years, we're certainly not going to fix all the things we promised at the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. We're saying, let's spend the money, we'll do the most good, so we will leave the world the most good in the next 15 years. That surely should be something that we could agree on. And in that way, I would say we have way too many SDGs. So I agree with Jacqueline. In principle, of course, we should do everything, and we should promise to do everything. But in reality, we're not going to do everything. And if we're not doing everything, I want us to do the things that will do the most good first. That also means challenging some annoying things, and that's probably why they invited me on the panels. I won't disappoint on that point. But for instance, one of the targets is to double renewable energy in the world. Now, that sounds really nice. That's about getting much more energy to the third world. That's great. That's wonderful. We estimate the total benefits of that would be in the order of $415 billion a year. That's great, both in improved energy access and also in reduced CO2 emissions. That's great. The problem is we estimate it will cost about $515 billion a year. So we're essentially spending a dollar and doing 80 cents worth of good. Let's just remember when we can do so many other things. Just to show you one other thing, we know, for instance, from Gavi, we can vaccinate kids more. We've vaccinated a lot, but we can actually vaccinate about, for $1 billion, we can probably save 1 million kids each year. So we can do so much more good. We estimate that will probably do about $60 worth of good for every dollar spent. So the idea here is to say, why don't we focus on where we can do the most good? And that's really one of the problems I want to highlight here, that there is an increasing problem in the way that climate and the climate conversation eats up, and very literally eats up, a lot of the new aid. Let's just take a look at what has come out. If you look at climate-related development aid from 1980 until the latest time we have data, what you see here is that it has increased dramatically. The OECD now estimates that for every $4 we spend on development, we spend $1 on climate-related development. That is a poor way of spending money. That's a poor way of helping the third world. Now, first, let me just point out, climate is a real problem. It's definitely something we need to tackle, but often we tackle it very costly and with very little benefit. It's one of the many problems we need to tackle. And again, just like with everything else, we need to ask, how much good do we do for every dollar spent? Let me just show you, because Jacqueline pointed out that 7 million people were participating in setting the SDGs. Actually, the UN asked people around the world, what should we focus on? They actually asked 8.5 million people across the world, what are the most important problems? It's called the world we want data. And this is what they told us. They said, education is the very most important issue. This doesn't quite work. It doesn't quite translate from Mac, apparently. For education, health, jobs, no corruption, and nutrition. Whereas, unfortunately, the very last thing they want is action on climate change. Of all the things we've asked 8.5 million people across the world, and presumably, if anything, this is biased towards climate, it tells us this is the least important issue. It doesn't say we shouldn't care about it at all, but it says there are 15 other things we should care about first. The fact that we spend 25% climate aid, spending on impacts that will do virtually no good in 2030, it's spending against what we promised, which is actually to develop developing worlds. It's spending against what the poor people want, and it's often spending on what's least effective, is not a good way to help the world. It's actually feel-good spending. It's making us feel good, but it's not doing very much good. And of course, remember, that money can't be spent on something that would do real good. And so that's why I'd like to just show you this one example, because I think we often forget what that means. I don't know if you've seen this, it's just been in the news. Greenpeace actually did the first fully powered solar village in India, and they were very, very proud of this, and they were saying it was a demonstration of a solution to India's energy access problems. These are some of the pictures that they showed, you know, wonderful kids loving it. It really lights up the world. It got lots of attention across the world in many, many different papers, had a big show on CNN as well. And of course, it makes you feel good. It makes you feel all warm and fuzzy inside. They actually showed us a way that you can generate power to a village that didn't have it before. This is what the village looked before, and now you get a light, and you actually get some light. I don't mean this in a facetious way. You actually do get some light. Remember, there's lots of light you still don't get. Look, the women, for instance, can now cook in the evening. But notice the solar panels are not nearly powerful enough to actually drive the stove. They only give you the light so you can cook, but you still have the tremendous indoor air pollution, which means they're coughing just as much and dying just as much from the most important environmental issue. And of course, the solar panels are so small that they also have to tell people, no, you can't use cookers, you can't use irons, you can't use fans. There's lots of stuff you can't use. But the real point here, of course, is when the minister then came a month after they had inaugurated the village, they used the opportunity to tell him with placards, we don't want this solar power. They actually said, we don't want fake electricity. We want real electricity. They actually said they wanted the real thing. They wanted the access shock, right? They want the same energy access as all the rest of us want. They actually want to be able to have real power that can drive their fridge, that can drive their stove, that can actually eliminate indoor air pollution. The point was, right now, solar panels cost in Danai about three times as much as what the Indian coal-fired power plants can provide power from. Perhaps not surprisingly, as the minister realized this was a really bad PR situation, he then provided the Indian village with real power a week later. So they're very, very pleased with Greenpeace giving them the solar panels because it meant that they got the ear of the minister, so they now have real power. But the issue here is to recognize that there's a very real choice. We can choose how we want to spend money. Take, for instance, Obama's $3 billion that he promised to spend for climate. Let's assume that this is invested in current solar in the way that we subsidize solar right now across the world. That means if you run it on a standard climate model, it will postpone global warming by 28 minutes by the end of the century. Let me also show you the alternative. We could spend that $3 billion on vaccines right now, and we could save 3 million kids today. My simple point here is to say, we do this all the time. We make choices when I'm finishing up. We make choices whenever we say, where are we going to spend money? If we spend money one place, it means we can't spend it somewhere else. We need to ask, what is best? And that's why, yes, when we ask about sustainability in 2015, we're actually doing pretty good, both in economy, society, environment. It does not mean that there are no problems, but remember the broad trends I showed you before? We are moving in the right direction, but we still need to talk about, so what should we do first? And that is really the challenge for our future. Thank you very much.